Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Welcome back, everybody, to Heritage Radio Network on Tour. I'm your host, Eli Sussman of The Line on Heritage Radio, and today we're broadcasting live down from Charleston. We want to thank the Julia Child Foundation for making our coverage possible, and of course, to Charleston Wine and Food Festival for having us down here. I'm joined by the Castellucci brothers, Federico and John. Welcome. I'm glad
you guys
could take some time to sit and talk with me about your business. We've got a chef. And we got the president and the CEO of the company. Who wants to tell sort of a little bit about the family story and the family brand of restaurants?
Yeah, Fred, you want to go?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it. It's, you know, the whole family story goes way back. Our first family restaurant was in 1917 in Providence, Rhode Island. And so, but over the years, you know, my father had restaurants up in Rhode Island, and we made our way down to Georgia in 1997, right after the Olympics. My dad had literally just lost everything in his business and put us in a Volvo station wagon with a dog and a cat and three kids and drove down south. So that's how we ended up in Atlanta. And ever since then, we've been kind of, you know, opening, you know, family kind of businesses, very, very mom and pop in the early days. You know, we'd open a restaurant and, you know, we'd work it together. And then, you know, my dad would sell it to somebody, and then we weren't working in that restaurant anymore. And, you know, we kind of just like bounce around from project to project. But the company as it is today, the seven restaurants that we have, six different concepts, really started around 2007. And that's when, you know, we all kind of came into the picture. And, you know, my first restaurant was taking over a restaurant that had gone out of business in St. Ives Shopping Center, which is out in the suburbs of Atlanta, and really just worked hard to turn that business around. It was extremely slow in the early days, and just kind of worked on building relationships one customer at a time. And that turned into ultimately Iberian Pig, and then Double Zero, Cooks and Soldiers, Bar Mercado, Recess, and a second version of Iberian Pig. And my brother John went to culinary school, and he can kind of tell his story a little bit. But my sister as well, who's with us, we're all in the business together. So
it's such explosive growth, 13 years, seven locations. When you had that first location going and it was feeling like it was kind of successful, do you remember back, were there discussions with your father amongst the family that, oh, we're definitely going to turn this into sort of a big sprawling powerhouse restaurant group? Was that the idea from the beginning, or did it just happen over time?
No, absolutely not. I mean, because even when we went to the second location, we were still pretty much broke at that point. And so when I signed the lease for Iberian Pig in Decatur, we literally didn't have the cash to get the restaurant open. So signed the lease and just decided, hey, let's figure this out. So
you kind of were jumping ahead, but you've kind of led me to one of my later questions, which is just fundraising. You know, a lot of people, what they do is they open one restaurant, it's successful, and they use the cash flow from that restaurant to leverage the second restaurant. You could call it a house of cards or a domino scenario, and hopefully it works out. But what you're saying is the opposite, that you kind of went into the second one and you didn't have a huge amount to really fall back on. You were kind of wagering it all, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we, you know, opening night on at Iberian Pig, we had about 15 grand in inventory on the food side, another 20 grand in alcohol unpaid for, which is illegal in the state of Georgia, by the way. And, you know, we had overdrawn all of our bank accounts, like negative 10 grand on opening night. So we were basically in a do or die situation.
Honestly, yeah. I feel like a little bit sick to my stomach just hearing that. And I know it was many years ago and you've made it past that, but that sounds tumultuous and kind of awful. Federico, I know that you went to Cornell, so you've always been the business side and you have always been the culinary side, right? Did you guys know from a young age that that would be the split? Were you always like running around front of house with like a bow tie on, and you were always in back messing around with knives?
It was actually quite the opposite at first. Fred always started in the kitchen, and would work saute at one of our restaurants, Roasted Garlic, at the time. And I would be kind of the busboy, going out to the tables, clearing the tables. And, you know, it was one of those things where I would always be in the dining room running around. Fred would always be in the kitchen. I would have him, like, you know, make me dinner or whatever the case may be. And then as we got older, I naturally found myself in the kitchen more often. Fred was kind of needed from a front of house perspective, just from a financial business running. As you can see, we were very smart business people early on. And so Fred going to Cornell and like learning, you know, all about how to actually run a business and not just like slide by the seat of our pants. When he came back to Atlanta, I was on my way off to culinary school. So we kind of two ships passing in the night almost.
Was there ever a point you went abroad, you were right at WD-50, you did stages all over the place. Was there ever a thought of not coming home and maybe staying in a different city and working somewhere else? Or did you always kind of feel that draw to return back to the Atlanta area?
No, I always felt the draw to, you know, return to the Atlanta area, but there's always like the drive to keep learning and pushing yourself and traveling. So which is why like traveling, getting out of your comfort zone and like trying to go eat as many places you can or do like a one day stage in a city you're not used to. I still do that randomly. But coming back to Atlanta was always, you know, part of my plan. Family is like a huge part of my life, and I can't imagine like the idea of, you know, them having a lot of stress and running the restaurants, and then me like living in another city, having like my own operation or anything going on like that. So
my brother is my business partner, and we have some family members that are
nice.
Unfortunately invested in our business.
Right.
As we all know, the two worst decisions you could ever make is work with family and then take money from your family, right? So a lot of the best arguments, a lot of the most positive things that have happened in the business have come out of these moments when we both are really trying to achieve something. We're trying to move the restaurant in the forward direction, but maybe we're coming at it from a different point of view. We've been lucky enough to work through those. Obviously, you guys are sitting here with me, so you must get along to a certain point. But tell me about if there's ever been moments when there's been an idea that's been brought to the table that has been not universally received, and maybe you had to fight for something. Maybe it was a dish. Maybe it was what the dining room would look like, spending a little extra money on food costs, whatever it might be. Can you talk a little bit about the tension and how you work through it?
Well, I'll say for the most part, it's been pretty smooth sailing, mostly because part of my strategy was to like throw as much shit against the wall as possible and just like try to see what sticks and pick up the pieces. And so everybody was so busy that like no one really had time to like get into these big arguments, because it's like a divide and conquer situation. Like as soon as Iberian Pig was successful, I was like, all right, we're doing Double Zero. And my sister Stephanie jumped in and like started running that concept. And when it was a challenging opening, like we jumped in and fixed it and made it better. And so the idea of just staying as busy as possible and doing something new has kind of prevented a lot of those big arguments. But I would say the biggest arguments were early on between myself and my dad, because, you know, when things were stressful from a financial situation, and, you know, I was trying my best to kind of right the ship and make improvements. And, you know, he had this kind of attitude of like, we were going to put as much value on the plate as possible, which meant our food cost was like 45%, you know? So like, you can't run a successful business with 45%, but every time you try to like cut the, you know, chicken breast from 14 ounces down to like 8 ounces, it's like a blowout argument, and he's, you know, walking out of the restaurant. So thankfully those arguments have subsided.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, you ran out of siblings and ran out of family to put in leadership positions. You have 7 spots.
Yeah.
You run a very large, sprawling operation. How many employees altogether now?
We're like 450 now.
So at a certain point, you had to get real serious and real professional about internal structures and hierarchy, and you can't be in every single kitchen, obviously, right? So what are some of the decisions? Let's talk to you, John, first about the culinary side. What are some decisions that you've made over the years that has allowed you to maintain consistency when you're not there, and also keep the group growing and keeping things quality high and successful where you feel good about maybe not having to touch every single plate that leaves the pass, you know?
No, and I think, honestly, this is a big thing, even in my short stint at WD-50, and, like, seeing how, like, Wiley runs that kitchen is, like, complete creative freedom for all the cooks. Like, I mean, everyone down from the stage that's been there for a month to the guy, the line cook that's been there for 2 years is expected to have something on the menu. It's like, okay, what are you working on lately? What are your ideas? And I think really just giving people the room to operate within that structure. So, you know, setting up a structure that's very organized in terms of like, this is how we're going to do our ordering, this is how we're going to do scheduling, this is how we're going to operate the line. But to kind of like motivate people to come up with their own ideas, motivate people to operate within their own space is really important. And I've always kind of had the role of being in the kitchen that's of the greatest need at the moment. So right now, you know, we just opened our newest location in Buckhead. So I'm there running the day-to-day operations. And then whenever we have, you know, a project that either needs a lot of help or attention or, you know, we spend a bunch of money at our new restaurant in Buckhead. So it's really important that I'm there making sure that that's operating at, you know, the highest level. So I think, you know, just really creating, hiring really good people and, you know, executive chefs at our restaurants that we really trust, put a lot of, you know, weight and value in. And then from a menu development perspective, just kind of helping guide whichever store I'm at the moment and support our other chefs within the company.
And then so from the business side, you know, there's a point at which your singular bookkeeper can't handle the load and things just kind of, they exponentially are growing and you need more bodies, right? So at what point, if any, did you install a director of operations? What are some steps that you took to make your workload hopefully a little bit easier and keep things sustainable?
Yeah, so we actually just hired our director of ops back in September. And he's been somebody huge. That was working with us as a consultant for about 2 years through some of our restaurant openings. He's been absolutely fantastic. And I feel like with every kind of successive opening, there's been a process that has been broken. And then you kind of have to get in and fix that. So like the very first process, honestly, was a lot of the kind of like marketing, graphic design, printing, like all of the kind of like the office side of things that doesn't include accounting. And so after our second restaurant, that was the first hire that we made. And then right after our third one, the next one was accounting because I had all the GMs doing their own books. And then I was going in and like verifying them, making sure that the money was there and things were not like totally broken. And that obviously is a process for, you know, a lot of issues. So we hired our head accountant who's still with us today and she's fantastic. So we've been able to like have little turnover on the corporate team and hire really qualified people and then put a lot on their plate.
Something that's always been important but has entered the discussion in a real dramatic way in the last couple years is safe work environments and maintaining or creating a type of, in your case, it's a corporate culture. You have 450 people that folks, they want to stay because the work is good and they feel good about staying for all the other reasons that you can create for them. So if there is anything that you've implemented in the last couple years that you can share with other folks that own restaurants that you feel are some of the things that you're really proud of on that front, not just we open 7 restaurants, but what are some other things that you do internally or externally facing that you guys are proud of?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that our industry is headed like towards a crisis when it comes to the workforce and just creating sustainable lifestyles. I think that, you know, one of the things that we're focused on right now is like, how do we make our restaurants more sustainable for people who want to have families? And, you know, generally it starts with our corporate culture, which, you know, we're serious about, you know, our mission and our values and making sure that that is aligned throughout the entire like hiring, onboarding, training, and, you know, ultimately discipline process so that our corporate culture is, you know, consistent across all the brands. And we are creating places that people want to work. I think, you know, the hardest thing about corporate culture is like creating one that's authentic and that can be duplicated. And one of the things that I think is oftentimes, you know, we can talk about benefits, which we do all those things. And, you know, you can talk about the bells and whistles, but at the end of the day, it's really about creating a culture of trust and integrity. And that has to start at the top and trickle its way through every decision-making process. So people know that when you say you're going to do something that you actually follow through on and you do it. And I think that, at the end of the day, that's the one thing that we have going for us as a family-owned company is that, you know, they know that there's not some private equity investor out there that's going to make a decision that gets trickled down to somebody that says, like, you have to, you know, cut costs on this or do something differently on that. Like, at the end of the day, we have the best interests of our people in mind, our guests in mind, and all of our decision-making flows from that perspective. And I think that as a family-owned company, that's, like, one of our biggest advantages.
And from a culinary perspective, you know, it's one of those things where you have, you know, your line cooks and your sous chefs, and it's almost, I always remind all of our, you know, hiring chefs, it's like, you know, this is almost, it's almost like dating. Like, you need to make sure they're trying you out as well. And if you're not stimulating them from a creative perspective, from a growth perspective, they're going to leave. And, you know, you see it so many times. Oh, I worked at this restaurant for 6 months. Then I worked for this restaurant group. Like, we're looking for people that want to stay with us for, like, multiple years. And so one thing, you know, that I do a lot is just sit down with them, you know, not during the working hours when we're getting crushed doing a busy service, but be like, hey, how's it going? You know, what do you want to learn? Like, what do you want out of this? And what can we do to make sure that we're helping your growth? And if that means that you want to transfer from Iberian Pig to go learn how to make fresh pasta at Double Zero because that's something you're passionate about, then, like, let's make that happen. Or if, you know, you're about to go to culinary school and you want to work on knife skills, like, then let's stay after and let's work on that together, you know?
Something that's great about opening more spaces is that you give people the opportunity to horizontally or vertically grow, right?
Exactly
what you're talking about right now. But how do you evaluate those new growth opportunities? Like, there can be a... there can be like an excitement that fuels opening spots that might not be directly correlated to success. And so by that, I mean, like, you can be hungry for it, but it can be the wrong type of hunger. So you guys have a lot of spots right now. I assume that in the Atlanta area and other states, you have people coming and knocking on your door. Hey, open here, consult on this. Mm-hmm. How do you make those choices about when you're ready to do something new? And then furthermore, any thoughts on leaving the Atlanta area for future projects?
Yeah, certainly. I think that the biggest decision about growth, there's a financial element to it, of course, because these things aren't free anymore. Our initial budgets on restaurants were super low, and now they've gotten more and more over the years. So that becomes challenging. Then there's the personnel element. If you're pushing the company too fast and too hard, you're gonna lose that excitement for growth. Like you said, you want your people to be, like, excited about new opportunities, not fearful, like, oh shit, what is this going to be like when like the whole thing comes crumbling down? So you want to do it in a way that feels good to the organization, but you're also pushing too, and it's going to stress the organization. So you have to have that kind of balance of, like, let's push and stress, but then let's make sure that we're doing a good job in the existing businesses. And that's really up to us to decide, like, are we actually doing a great job at all of our other businesses before we decide to move forward with something new? And I think that that's, you know, one of the things we've done pretty well is we've looked back after every opening and say, all right, where does everything else stand? Do we feel good about, you know, the success we have everywhere else? If we feel good about that, then let's forge forward. If we don't, it's time to, like, dive in and fix and work on things. And so we're kind of in the, like, diving in and working on mode on all the other businesses. So, you know, while we are looking at new stuff, we're not getting too serious about it.
It's about talent too. I feel like if you have the talent and you have an idea, and you have someone that you feel like is super talented that can execute that idea. But we let a lot of times the people within our organization, especially from a culinary perspective, as they grow, like, oh, this would be the perfect opportunity for them in this capacity. And so I think it's a lot of people, like a people thing as well.
Sometimes there's a tendency when you're very close to your business partner or, like, you're related to them, it can sometimes be the opposite of the disagreements that we talked about. It can be like an echo chamber where you both kind of build each other up. And it's nice to sometimes have an outside voice from outside the organization, outside the family. Do either of you, both of you, have a mentor or someone that you pick up the phone and call, maybe in the Atlanta area, maybe not, who you bounce things off of that might bring a new perspective to things that are going on in your day to day?
That's a good question. I have a friend in New York who's also in a family run restaurant with his brother and his parents. So a lot of times I'll reach out to him and just kind of, like, pick his brain about, you know, the issues he's dealing with, or you know, how involved he is in their day-to-day operation. And it's good just to kind of have someone that is going through something similar as you that's not a family member, just to kind of vent to and go through those options.
I think it's critical.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you got to have an outside voice.
Vent to who isn't a family member is like the most sane thing you can do. Exactly. Yeah,
for sure.
And what about you? Is there something that you reach
absolutely
out to?
I mean, I have there's a small group of restaurateurs. There's four of us. We do like a quarterly meeting, and they're based in different cities all over the country. So not like competitor. And we kind of do like a once a quarter deep dive into some of the business issues that we're having. So that's been extremely helpful for me. And then just picking up the phone and kind of reaching out to other friends in the business. And, you know, we do like a once every 6 month dinner with like a few of my buddies who own restaurants in Atlanta, and just have like kind of like a bitch sesh. But, you know, it is helpful though.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you out of here on this last question. I'd like for both of you to tackle it. But basically, now that you have several places open, you understand what it's like to go from two to three. If there's really one piece of advice that you could hone in on to someone who's has their first restaurant and thinks that they're ready for the second restaurant, is there something that you did wrong or that you did right that you can offer up to them as they're sort of embarking on their expansion?
I think for me, it would just be make sure that you have the human capital to do it, and make sure you have people who you trust. I think the worst thing is to be opening a restaurant and trying to hire all positions. I think if you have, you know, people that you really trust, that, you know, can be your voice of reason when you're not in the building, I think that's probably the most important thing.
Yeah, I think most people, when they go from one to two, they just split themselves in half. And that becomes really, really challenging because you can't be in both places at once. So you really need to make sure that you have somebody that's taking care of number one. But at the same time, you know, you can't just labor over it forever. Like, you have to get out and do. And like, if I had just sat there and tried to perfect everything we were doing at one, we never would have opened Iberian Pig, which was our most successful concept, and then opened a second location. And the growth of the company never would have happened. I would have just been toiling out, you know, in Johns Creek for years trying to like get that business off the ground. And while it's great today, it's taken us, you know, 13 years to get that business to great. We never would have done any of this. So like, at the end of the day, you just got to sack up and do it.
Federico and John, thanks so much for being here. Can you shout out? There's got to be a website that contains all the restaurants, right? Where can they go and find out?
Yeah, for sure. CHGrestaurants.com.
Cool.
Or just find us on Instagram. All the businesses are on that.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for taking some time. I hope you enjoy the rest of your time down here in Charleston. Everybody listening, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with way, way, way more content from Heritage Radio Live down here in Charleston. Thank you so much to the Julia Childs Foundation for supporting us, and of course, to the Charleston Food and Wine Festival for letting us come down here and broadcast live. We'll be right back here on Heritage Radio.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.